Hey, Murderheads, I'm Tay, one of your hosts.
And I'm Nikki, your other host.
And together, we are Murder, She Taped.
We were really struggling on what to what to talk about. Our weeks have been, I would say, depressing.
Yeah, I'd say it's pretty depressing.
Yeah, I mean, I started therapy today and got to talk about my problems, which apparently I have a lot more than I thought.
I did my therapy homework this week.
Oh, how did that go? Okay, tell them what your homework was.
I had to watch a video and then tell which one I was. And I'm like, passive.
For love language, right?
No, this is a different one. So I had, like, yeah, we talked about love language, but then we also talked about love something else, and so I had to figure out which one my sign was or whatever. Yeah. So I'm passive something, which means I'm like insecure in relationships and I like want to be needed and shit, which is weird.
Yeah, knowing you, because you're kind of like, I want
space.
Yeah,
but we're not dating.
Yeah, but even in like, well, I guess in friendships, I would say you're a little bit more on the needy side, on the friendship level.
That's because I'm not that needy.
Really?
When have I needed you?
You love communication.
Oh, I love communication. But then I also had to write out 10 things that I appreciate in a relationship and then 10 things that worry me about having a relationship.
Ooh.
And it got right fucking sad.
Do explain.
I was like, I was crying writing them.
Oh.
Because it sucked. And then I have to do it all over again. I have to talk to her again, all over again. So, what's your homework for therapy?
I think not as dramatic as yours. So we're gonna be working on self-love and self-care, which I find super ironic since I preach to other women all the time about how important self-love and self-care is, and I don't do it.
Yeah.
Especially lately, like I had 2 cigarettes today.
Ugh. Although I've been craving cigarettes and I just haven't smoked,
so. I think we're just going through a phase. I'm really
is thinking, it a phase?
I hope so. I really hope
so. Can I have phases at 26?
Yes.
Yeah? Okay.
Julie has phases at 51.
Yes, I mean, Julie, you're so similar. That's why you get along with your mom so well.
Yeah, probably. Impulsive.
Every time I walk in, she's like, do you want wine? And I always say no, but I always want to say yes.
I'm sure Julie wants you to say yes, too.
She wants me. I know. She asked me multiple times.
Yeah, so I have to work on doing, like, self-care every day, whether it's 2 minutes or 20 minutes, but I have to do something. And then she was like, so what's self-care to you? I'm like, oh, like, I guess exercise. She's like, no. Self-care isn't something that you know you should do, but you don't want to. Self-care is something that you can recharge. Like, for her, she loves to do her makeup. So she gets 30 minutes where she can shut the door, her husband takes care of their kids, and she does her makeup.
Oh.
So I hate doing my makeup. I do my makeup every day, but I don't enjoy doing it. So that's not going to work for me. And then, I literally sat down with her and I was like, oh, I guess I like reading or I like writing. I like baths. I do like to go for runs with Milo. But I don't like the gym. So she was like, well, then that's lots we can work on. And then I don't mind meditation when I take the time to do it. So I might do a little bit of meditation, but I don't know. It's just hard to prioritize yourself. Because then that means you're actually working on yourself, and I don't really want to work on myself. I just want to be perfect right now. So, yeah. I didn't cry, though, in therapy. Like, and then she was like, well, maybe, like, that's a bad thing, though. Like, maybe you're just, like, burying all of your emotions super deep so that you don't cry. I'm like, well, I probably am. Yeah, she thinks that.
Burying.
Burying.
Burying?
I'm pretty sure it's burying.
Burying. I don't know. Okay.
Burying. B-U-R-Y-I-N-G.
Oh, you are right. I would say burying. Fuck, I'm bad at English.
But I don't know if I'm right or if you're right, to be quite honest. Or maybe we're both right. Like, maybe it's one of those stupid, like, old English, new English things.
Maybe. Z and Z.
Well, that's American versus Canadian. Like, keener. Keener is a Canadian keener thing, for those of you who did not know. I thought that was just, like, a universal term.
No, keener.
You're keen on something. You're a keener.
Or double-double, apparently that's not, like, very common in the States.
Because they never had a Timmy's, and I feel really bad for them about that. Do they have Timmy's now? Or is Timmy's still Canadian?
I think it's Canadian.
Huh. I thought that was going to change. Well, our week has been
so many weeks.
So depressing. And we're about to dive into something that gets a lot more depressing. So bear with us, murder heads, because this story is long and as in-depth as I could possibly make it. And this is episode 5, The Beast from BC. Olson was a middle-aged habitual criminal and informant when from January 1980 until August 1981, he stalked, tortured, and killed at least 11 youngsters. He sexually abused scores of others. The heinous nature of his crimes ensured infamy, but more than that, Olson is reviled because he blackmailed authorities into paying his family $100,000 for the return of his victims' remains.
My God.
A cash for corpses deal that destroyed careers and tormented their survivors. Before kinky sex killers Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka, before the pig farm butcher, there was the Beast of BC, aka the rent-a-car killer, because of his penchant for hiring another new car after each slaying. He savored kiddie porn, was recognized as a sexual deviant, and lived most of his life in a steel concrete cage. Back in 1980, however, Vancouver was truly a provincial city. Expo 86 was 6 years away, and the newspapers from other provinces or countries still could take days to arrive. So this is back before all of the up-to-date technology and stuff, where people could communicate a little bit more thoroughly.
Yep.
The Lower Mainland was a patchwork quilt of nascent municipalities and a hodgepodge of police jurisdictions. There was little coordination among the different RCMP detachments and civic police forces, and the computer revolution had yet to occur. Before he was caught, Olson terrorized the province. Neighborhoods that once claimed to be so safe you could leave your door open locked up. Hitchhikers disappeared from the highways, and telephone poles were emblazoned with posters warning that nearly a dozen youngsters were missing and a killer was on the loose. In every real way, his merciless savagery robbed British Columbians of their innocence and attendant faith that such monsters only lurked elsewhere. There were many factors that allowed Olson to prey on children and adolescents across BC and elsewhere in Canada for 19 months before being arrested.
Oh shit, that's a long time.
It is. Born on January 1st, 1940, a New Year's Day baby, Clifford Olson was a bad seed. The eldest child of Clifford and Leona, Clifford Jr., grew up in a small house near the Pacific National Exhibition grounds. His dad delivered milk in those days and was one of the last to drive a horse-drawn cart. Later, Clifford Sr. worked in construction and as an apartment building manager. Leona was a housekeeper. After the war, the family moved to the sprouting suburb of Richmond into one of the many housing schemes for returning veterans. A short, stocky kid, Olson was always a problem. He was always getting into fights and getting beaten up, his father, Clifford Olson Sr., remembered later. One day, he said, "Dad, I'm going to learn to be a boxer." As soon as he did, he began making the rounds of the boys who had beaten him up and started evening the score. Maybe that's his trouble, that chip on his shoulder. He began to skip class when he was only 10 years old, and after completing grade 8, quit altogether to embrace a life of crime. Leona bore two more sons, Richard and Dennis, and a daughter, Sharon. All grew up to be law-abiding, middle-class people. But if she could boast of their achievements with Clifford, she was always making excuses. He was a loner, a loser, and a perennial failure who was jailed for the first time on July 19, 1957. He was 17 years old. Over the following 24 years, he chalked up nearly 100 convictions. Obstructing justice, possession of stolen property, possession of firearms, forgery, false pretenses, fraud, parole violation, impaired driving, theft, break and enter and theft, armed robbery, escape from lawful custody, rape, burglary, gross indecency, and finally, first degree murder.
Just a little fuck.
He escaped jail 7 times.
Oh my God.
Released in January of 1980, Olson picked up where he left off and continued his lifelong crime spree. It was all he knew how to do. Of course, however, the police didn't draw connections to the newly freed Olson and the death of 12-year-old Christine Weller, the first of the Lower Mainland children to go missing. Colleen Dagnault, 13 was the second of the Lower Mainland children to go missing at around the same time. And people who knew her found this odd because Colleen wouldn't just go and talk to anyone. She was shy. She was only 13. It's not like she had a super outgoing personality at that point. It didn't make sense.
So she went missing?
Yeah. People were shocked because the comment about her is how shy she was. So,
I mean, he could have just nabbed her. Did he just nab her?
He had a method to his madness, okay. And we'll get there. Ooh. A few months after getting out of prison, Olson seduced Joanne Hale, a locally reared divorcee who had survived a violent, abusive marriage. They got married and had a son, Stephen, in April of 1981 in the midst of Olson's killing spree. And they married a month later. So they had the kid first and then they got married. Okay. Now, April 22nd, 1981, before their wedding, Clifford Olson took the life of Darren Johnsrud, who had only been in the Vancouver area for 2 days. 3 days after the wedding ceremony, Olson murdered another teenager. May 19th, 1981, Sandra Lynn Wolfsteiner, 16 years old, was watched by her boyfriend's mother as she got into a man's car. Olson took Sandy to the bush of Chilliwack Lake Road, where he attacked and killed her by striking her on the head.
Did his wife know this?
She claims she had no idea. Okay. June 21st, 1981, so just a month later, Ada Court, who was 13 years old, was babysitting at her brother and sister-in-law's apartment in Qualicum, thank you. The same apartment complex that the Olsons family lived and worked as caretakers. Sunday morning, Ada caught a bus to meet her boyfriend. She never made it back to her boyfriend's location. She simply vanished. 52-year-old Jim Peronto, a White Rock resident, believed he witnessed Olson disposing of Ada's body, but didn't make the connection. July 2nd, 1981, so a week-ish later, Simon Partington, who was 9 years old, would eventually be considered the turning point of the case of the missing Lower Mainland children. At 10:30 a.m., after Simon's usual big bowl of cornflakes, he dressed in blue jeans and a blue t-shirt, hopped on his bike with his brand new orange Snoopy book, and headed for a friend's house. He never arrived. He disappeared only a few blocks from where Christine Weller was last seen alive. He had just finished a school project where he wrote The Hungry Tiger and Gullible Duck, almost a foreshadow to his untimely death. A 9-year-old.
So did he not have like a type? He just had kids in general?
He does have a type. Okay. And we will get there.
I'm trying to put this together and I'm struggling.
So notice that he's going for people that are 18 and younger.
Yeah.
Most of them are between the ages of 13 and 15. Simon being a really young mm-hmm. kid for him. But it's like he's going for people who he knows he can overpower. Okay. And he knows he can manipulate. Mm-hmm. And he knows he can earn trust with. Mm-hmm. All right. Okay. 7 days later, Thursday, July 9th, Randy Ludlow, who was 18, and Olson are driving around together. Randy was unaware that only a week prior, Olson had murdered Simon, and 2 days prior had been, so 2 days prior from July 9th, had been charged with indecent assault on a 16-year-old girl. Ludlow rendered eyewitness to the last few hours of Judy's life. Now, Judy Cosma was 14 years old and was leaving a phone booth on Columbia Street in front of the Royal Columbian Hospital. Olson obviously knew her because when Olson waved to her, Judy waved back and smiled before coming up to the truck to talk. And just before I get deeper in, this is all from Ludlow's perspective in an interview later. Okay. Turns out Clifford Olson had met Judy at her part-time job at McDonald's where she worked as a cashier. She'd been on her way to Richmond to see a friend about applying for another part-time job at Wendy's. The shy brunette was desperately looking for a second part-time job. "Hop in," Olson had said. "We will take you there." She was thankful to not have to bus it all the way through Vancouver. Olson offered the two youths beer that was already in his truck, which they both accepted. They arrived in Richmond a lot earlier than her interview time, and it was way too early to meet up with her friend, so they stopped at the Richmond Inn to buy some more beer. At one point, Olson handed Ludlow a wad of money to impress Judy, only to take it away when getting more liquor. When we returned to the car, Judy sat in the front passenger seat, and I sat in the back, Ludlow recalled. Olson offered Judy a job cleaning windows at $10 an hour, which she seemed interested in. They then returned to New Westminster, because it seems like she had accepted the job, where Olson bought a bottle of rum, cups, and Coke. Olson encouraged Judy to have another drink, but you could tell she was hesitant, Ludlow explains. Olson gave instructions to Ludlow to pour her a drink, despite Judy saying she didn't want any more. So, Ludlow said, I gave her a glass of Coke with no rum, and then once I caught Judy's eye, I signaled it was only Coke. She took a sip of the Coke and made a comment, this is really strong, playing with the act. Olson looked back at Ludlow and nodded his approval. He then gave Judy three green pills, saying, here, take these, they'll straighten you out and keep you from getting drunk. Judy, worried about being drunk when she returned home from the interview, or maybe she was still hoping to make the interview and didn't want to be drunk in it, took the pills.
Oh, no. Judy!
Olson parked in the underground garage at his apartment complex, and Ludlow and Judy stayed in the car. Ludlow would later reflect that this was the only time he detected any anxiety from Judy. She was nervous and upset at that time. He put it down to her being only 15, drinking, and bailing on her interview. She was crying, so I helped her wipe her tears before Olson returned, and then she was herself again. Olson dropped Ludlow off at Lougheed Mall, and the next time that Ludlow saw Olson, he was told that by Olson that he had dropped Judy back off at Richmond. Ludlow later learned that he had actually murdered Judy before leaving with his wife, Joan, and son to Knott's Berry Farm in L.A. the next day.
Oh my gosh.
July 23rd, 14 days after Judy went missing, Raymond King, who was 15, was enjoying his summer holidays and looking for his first real job. He made his routine trip to the Canada Manpower Youth Center, which I'm assuming is kind of like a staffing agency or a temp agency, chaining his bike behind the building. He had come to the center often, and the staff were beginning to know him a little bit more personally. Young Ray met Olson that day. He was lured by the promise of work, a lie Olson had told many times before. Then Olson drove them on a route he knew well along Highway 7 towards Harrison Mills and Weaver Lake. Turning off the highway, he headed to a popular camp that led to a BC Forest Service campground beside Alpine Lake. It was here that he staved the boy's head with rocks and then dumped the youngster's body off the steep hillside trail. The night that Olson killed Raymond, he logged 403 kilometers in the rental car that he had rented from Metro to Coquitlam. Why am I struggling?
Qualicum.
Man, I'm never moving there.
It's fucking beautiful. It's
a
beautiful town, though.
I'm going to be there in Coquitlam. Qualicum. Once he was reported missing, police knew that there had to have been foul play with Raymond. And the reason being is because he had chained his bike behind the building. And one of the sergeants said that if a kid's going to be a runaway, he's either going to take the bike with him, or he's going to sell it for a couple bucks to get to where he's going, or he's just going to leave it at home because who the fuck cares about a bike?
Yeah.
So he... It showed intention that he was planning on returning to his bike later, and then he didn't.
Yeah.
2 days later, on Saturday, July 25th, 1981, Sigrun, a visiting German student from Weinheim, Germany, somewhere in Germany, a small Rhine Valley town, was spotted with Olson in Qualicum at a pub. And then later, by a couple of passengers in a passing train where she was crouched with a, in quotations, middle-aged man who turned out to be Olson. It wasn't until August 28th, nearly a month after she had went missing, that the police had found her body and then contacted the sister of Mrs. Arnd and said, and was told what had happened to her. So her parents went a month without knowing what the hell happened to their daughter because they're back in Germany.
Yeah.
Her mom and her dad commented that she was intelligent and suspicious. I mean, we discussed frequently how she would never get into a stranger's car, not to mention hitchhike, but obviously in Canada she did. So Sigrun left behind a diary that raved about all the trips via boat and horseback that she'd been having in BC, but most of all, the friendliness, open-hearted, and eager to help locals. So she really built a lot of relationships with some new strangers. Yeah. And so they're sure that that's how she lost all of her timidness and caution. It was only after Olsen later confessed during an interrogation once he was caught that they learned who actually killed her.
Oh, so they didn't know until he said.
No. Wow. Her body was found partly buried in a trench only 400 yards away from where Simon had been buried, the 9-year-old.
This guy just can't stop.
We're not even there.
These are like days apart.
2 days after Sigrun's murder.
What the hell?
Monday, July 27th, Terry Lynn Carson, who's 15 years old, had left the family home Monday morning at about 8 o'clock. A small, thin girl, about 105 pounds and a little over 5 feet, was no match for Olsen, who stopped and offered her a ride that included a drink with drugs. She was just another girl looking for a summer job, so his typical ruse of offering her work worked out fairly well for Terry Lynn. Well, not for her, but worked when at that exact moment. He presented the drink as a congratulations for getting the job. He then drove out to the north shore of Fraser River, turned off Rossdale, a rural area, and then here in the forest, he strangled her, burned her clothes, and threw her purse and shoes into the Fraser River. 3 days later, Thursday, July 30th.
And his wife didn't have any idea. Like, come on.
I know. The final of the missing Lower Mainland children would be murdered. After meeting with police earlier that day, Olsen went to meet with his lawyer, Bob Schatz. On the way, he spotted a 17-year-old, Louise Chartrand, who was described as a very tiny, young-looking girl for her age. The youngest of 7 children, her and her 3 sisters had migrated from Quebec, settling in the Fraser Valley town of Maple Ridge, only 20 miles east of Vancouver. Police believed Louise hitchhiked part of her way to a night shift serving job with a man. After she was dropped off, she headed for the store in downtown Mission to buy cigarettes. It was only 10 minutes from the store to her place of work, and during this time, Olsen got her into his car, drugged her, and then headed to Whistler. On the way with Louise, he even stopped to get his confiscated gun back from the police department. Like, he stopped with her in the car.
Oh my god. He just, like, he thinks he's, like, too good for everyone.
Yeah.
And obviously he is. I mean, he got away with it.
The only reason he didn't get his gun back was because he was turned away since the officer wasn't available that he needed to release the weapon. He then headed for the treacherous killer highway that led to Whistler, only about 45 minutes from Squamish, BC. He drove north of the ski resort to a gravel pit, smashed Louise's skull with repeating hammer blows, burying her in a shallow grave. Louise's fellow employees at Beano's called her family when she did not arrive for her 8 p.m. shift. One of Louise's sisters then phoned the RCMP, which was detached the next morning. Joanne Hale, his wife, said she knew nothing of the crimes and presented herself at the time as a victim. Olsen lived off her divorce settlement and abused her too, she said. Hale refused to return the money Olsen extorted from the then attorney, General Alan Williams. His handling of the Faustian Pact ended Williams' career as a provincial politician.
Oh, shit.
The police investigated Olsen, one of Canada's first serial killer cases, was heavily criticized because he was able to kill and kill again, even after detectives identified him as a prime suspect. Olsen was able to initially elude detection in part because of his reputation as a rat. The cops at first thought of him as a resource, not a suspect, and they had some reason. In 1976, inside Prince Albert Penitentiary, Olsen was stabbed 7 times by a gang of prisoners, angry after he betrayed and identified for authorities' prison drug couriers. So he was a rat. While incarcerated, Olsen also provided police with enough information to ensure the conviction of a fellow inmate who raped, mutilated, and strangled a 9-year-old girl. Olsen, who was always revved up on alcohol and pills, had a standard routine to lure adolescents. He met them in video parlors and similar youth hangouts, or he advertised for them on the bulletin board of People's Full Gospel Church, a Baptist congregation where he and Joan worshipped.
Oh my god.
Olsen handed out... Right?
This guy.
Olsen handed out a flashy 3D card that identified him as a construction contractor. Under the disguise of conducting a brief informal job interview, he identified his potential victims and sought out the naive. which is why he always went for kids. He always went for the younger looking ones. He never, I mean, Ludlow was 18. He didn't fuck with Ludlow.
Yeah, true.
He'd hold out for the prospect of a job, give them a ride to a fictitious construction site, and along the way, offer them celebratory sip of Mickey of a Mickey Finn, a pop or bottled cocktail spiked with chloral hydrate, a knockout drug.
Oh my God.
Once he overpowered the youngster, Olson engaged in sadistic experiments on children. He drove a 3-inch spike into one of the child's heads. Another he injected with an air embolism. He talked about them as science experiments and fantasized about fame under the name Silver Hammer Man, a reference to the Beatles song.
So is that why he just went for, like, not just girls, he went for boys and girls, because it wasn't sexual?
It was not sexual. Jeez. He had sexual tendencies,
yeah.
But all of these murders, I mean, he didn't, there's not a lot of talk about how he raped or there was sexual assault. Mm-hmm. It was all strangulation.
Yeah.
Or knockout to the head. That was his choice of murder. Olson scattered their bodies from the bogs and cranberry fields of the Fraser River Delta to the abandoned quarries and canyons of the coastal mountains. He randomly picked his victims from a similarly large swath of the lower mainland, so the lack of coordination among regional police departments and the RCMP worked to his advantage. The career criminal had honed his awareness of police procedures. Because he had so many fucking convictions.
Because he's been in jail so many times.
When distraught parents initially complained about the police in action and to speculate about the existence of a serial killer, investigators downplayed such fears. They insisted it was likely missing teens that had just run away.
The runaways. It's always a thing.
And it's always something that delays a case like this. Yeah. That is so important.
Like, come on.
It took investigators an agonizingly long time to link disappearances that occurred in different jurisdictions. In the end, however, even the police were forced to acknowledge the obvious as the number of disappeared neared doubled digits. Like, we're talking, I think it got to 11 kids confirmed.
Wow.
At the investigation's peak, more than 200 officers were committed to the case. The pressure on police and politicians to find the children and the perpetrator was intense. It was fueled by frenzied media coverage. Cunning killer with blazing eyes would shout one headline, and then hot summer help slayer elude police would say another. A later inquiry identified many problems with the police response to the disappearances and killings. It recommended various independent police departments to join in the use of the RCMP computer and the establishment of a central data bank and review of RCMP procedures for handling multi-jurisdictional crimes. Nevertheless, 2 decades later, the lack of integration among the lower mainland police agencies would remain a problem and be blamed as a contributing factor in the downtown Eastside missing women's case. When Olson was actually arrested in mid-August 1981, the beast turned out to be a banal, beefy rounder with cow orbs. He stood 5'7", weighed maybe 160 pounds, and sported a mop of brown hair. Not what you pictured.
No.
But it makes sense as to why he's going for such little people. It's because he's little. He's not a big guy. And no wonder he's drugging them, because even half the 15-year-olds probably could have fought back if they were in the right state of mind.
Oh, yeah.
And no wonder he didn't fuck with the 18-year-old Ludlow.
Yeah, I wouldn't.
Police, though, had scant evidence against him and only 4 bodies. During his interrogation, Olson offered to lead police the remains of the children who hadn't been found. He also said he would return some of their jewelry and clothing, which he had kept as souvenirs.
Oh my God, like trophies. Ugh.
Tapes of the interrogation sessions, notes from the investigators, and later reminiscences provided a vivid, unsettling picture of what happened. "I'll give you 11 bodies for $100,000, Olson told the interrogators. "You want $100,000 for 11 bodies, RCMP Corporal Fred Mile stammered incredulously, like he was shocked. "Yes," Olson continued, "and you will get statements with the bodies. I will give you all the evidence, the things only a killer would know."
Why are you going to do that? You're like, you're going to go to jail. Why would you?
He wants money for his wife and his kid.
Aw.
I'm not saying he's right. This is fucked up. But that was his intention. So okay. The detective said, well, just a minute. We would have to work something out. I wouldn't just pay you $100,000. You could rip us off. Also, I have to have something to tell or show my bosses that you are, in fact, credible. So Olson replied, okay, I'll give you a freebie. I will give you one body and a statement. You will have the $100,000 in cash, and we are finished at the scene. I will phone you, or you will phone your man, who will hand the money over to Joan, his wife. Then you can talk to your man, and I will talk to Joan to make sure she has the money, and then we'll go on and get the rest.
What is happening?
What if your lawyer doesn't go along with it? The had asked, so the guy that he's negotiating with. Like I told you before, Olson crowed, he works for me. So this guy's cocky as fuck.
Yeah.
The killer...
He's 5'6", though. Men that are 5'6".
He probably drove a jacked up truck.
They're fucking cocky.
He did drive a truck. We know this. Probably had a lift. Might have had tint.
Did they have Oakleys back then? The white Oakleys?
Pit Vipers are the new Oakleys.
Oh, shit. Pit Vipers.
The killer dictated his proposal, and Mile wrote it down on a single page in sloppy handwriting scrawl. This is an undertaking of an agreement between the RCMP and Clifford Robert Olson. The following will be paid by the RCMP to Mrs. Joan Olson for the following information. $10,000 cash for each body of missing persons, up to 7 bodies. $30,000 for the information of 4 bodies which have already been recovered, which relate to the above 7 other missing persons. The agreement should be as undertaken, shall be binding in law as to not disclose the information in this agreement to the Canadian press. The following missing persons are covered in this agreement: Judy Cosma, Darren Johnsrud, Raymond King, Simon Partington, Ada Court, Louise Chartrand, Christine Weller, Terry Lynn Carson, Colleen Dagnault, and Sandra Wolfsteiner, and one unidentified female, which turned out to be Sigrun Arndt, a German student tourist police weren't aware was missing. $10,000 will be paid to Mrs. Olson, up to a total of the recovery of 7 bodies.
Okay, and she didn't know about this? Because if, like, you went as a cop, like, wouldn't you go to her and be like, this is what your husband's saying?
I don't know, because she could have tipped her husband off and he could have ran. And okay. What I didn't include in this is he escaped prison 7 times, but the only time he's ever been caught was by police dogs. He was literally hiding under a bunch of leaves, and 50 law enforcement and RCMP officers must have, like, literally walked right over him and couldn't find him because of how well he could hide until they brought out the police dogs. So
I guess he is pretty small too.
Yeah. So I think they were just in fear of him taking off.
Yeah.
So later, Olson called his wife Joan and said, honey, you're going to be rich. Oh. As the minister responsible for the legal system, Williams...
What did Joan say? Do we know?
No. I'm sure she said, fuck yeah.
Hell yeah.
I mean, $100,000 isn't that
get
rich,
it, girl.
But... Williams was required to approve what most considered a very real deal with the devil. If Williams didn't agree to the terms, he was told there was a chance that Olson might slip back onto the street to kill again. Which he did. As soon as he was released in January 1981, he killed 2 girls in the span of like a month.
Yeah. And then took one of them back to the police station to get his gun.
Yeah.
Like, come on. They had valid fears.
And he obviously wasn't bothered by it if he was able to get married 2 days later and then he went on honeymoon and then he took his kid, like, to Knott's Berry Farm.
Total psychopath.
There wasn't a shred of evidence, the investigator said. The pact was the only way to ensure he was convicted. I don't know how this guy got through, but it was clearly an excruciating decision for investigators, because they're making a deal with the devil, they're giving this guy $100,000 for disclosing information, and then in that same breath they don't have any evidence. How good was this guy at what he did?
Well, how far back was it though? You said it was pretty far back, so maybe they didn't have DNA or anything.
1981.
Do they have DNA in 1981?
I have no idea. Probably not. The tent girl went missing around that time, or like wasn't that when like the yogurt shop killers happened too, and they didn't have enough DNA at the time? No one disputes that there is a secret economy to the Canadian judicial system, a subterranean marketplace where lawyers and prosecutors haggle over charges, plea bargains, and guarantees of immunity. I mean, let's take a look at O.J. Simpson. Mm-hmm. There is a cardinal rule, however, in all such bargains, where the criminal should never be allowed to profit. Crime should not pay. Williams and the police could not allow Olson to directly receive the money. That would just be too much of an outrage. So within days, Olson was escorted to the office high in the old verdigris roofed sun tower. He was not in handcuffs. He strutted around the 17th floor as if he was a celebrity, smoking a white owl cigar and commanding a handful of lawyers, secretaries, his wife, and police.
Holy fuck.
Does your husband know what he's doing? Asked Joan's lawyer. She was catatonic and could only nod mutely. Olson put a hand on her shoulder and muttered, "What can I say, honey? I did it. It was the booze and the pills."
Oh my god, this guy sounds like a nut.
Olson told the lawyers how he wanted the money distributed. Some would pay their fees, some would go to his parents, and he wanted to ensure Joan and their baby son were looked after. He suggested his lawyer, Robert Shantz, write a book about the case called Kiss Daddy Goodbye. After the legal paperwork was signed, RCMP Sergeant Jack Randall unzipped a black, soft-sided underarm briefcase. He withdrew several bundles of wrinkled, old-issue bills bound with elastic bands. He handed them to McNeeney's partner, lawyer Kevin Morris, who counted the money onto the table. $1,000, $2,000, $3,000. Olson, the ever-present stogie, clamped between his teeth, could barely contain himself. His eyes gleamed. $8,000, $9,000, $10,000.
Are they actually paying him?
There were 99 rose-colored $1,000 bills and 10 maroon hundreds.
What?
Mm-hmm.
What's happening?
McNeeney later said the scene was so bizarre he half expected a sulfurous explosion and Satan himself to appear. Imagine an honest-to-goodness blood money deal for bodies.
Satan's 5'6". I love it. With moppy hair, moppy brown hair.
I can't get past your obsession with height. Like, I feel like we had this last time where you're like, she's only 5'1". And I was like, yeah, she was tall for 11. And you were just so stuck on the height. And now we're on the height thing again.
It's just funny.
Funny because I'm, oh my God, I'm like 5'6". Like, he's like.
It's you.
He's like my height.
With moppy brown hair.
Gross. If the deal-making scene had been surreal, the grisly caravan to recover the remains was something from a Twilight Zone. Olson traveled in a car with four detectives, followed by a dog car. Behind, there were usually three or four other vehicles carrying forensic specialists to handle the crime scenes. Corporal Mail, holding a large tape recorder, sat in the back seat with Olson, who held a microphone. The killer wore a regulation RCMP hat as a disguise and dictated as they went, describing the local and circumstances of each murder with the panache of a sports announcer. The hourly radio broadcast about the search for more bodies provided a ghastly play-by-play.
Oh my god.
Television newscasts featured scenes of the excavation teams draining suburban wetlands. Olson liked the forest-cloaked hills around Weaver Lake and the peaty bottomland north of River Road for disposing his victims. One body was mummified by the time it was found. Others were so badly decomposed, only pathologists could identify them. Mm. He pantomimed a reenactment of each murder, and then police would call McNeeney and release the required amount of money. The lawyer deposited it first in the Bank of Montreal at Homer and Hastings in downtown Vancouver, but later would transfer it offshore to protect it from police seizure. In between recovering his victims, Olson and the police dined at local steakhouses where the murderer wolfed down thick sirloins and baked potatoes.
I don't understand what's happening here.
I know. He kept scores of mementos to remind himself of each child's suffering and death throes, trophies to validate his kills. While he awaited trial, Olson was the topic of conversation at every courthouse, police station, jail, and legal catholicalish in the province. That is the worst word I've ever seen in my life. Like, is that gibberish?
I don't know what that
it's
is.
It's spelled K-A-F-F-E-E-K-L-A-T-S-C-H.
I'm not very good at English, I don't know.
I am, and I don't know what that is. What? He even called reporters to brag about the deal he struck and bitch about the jail conditions. I can't stand the treatment, he would complain. The other prisoners tossed trash and lighted cigarettes at him. They shoved him when he passed. While his clothes were in storage, someone ripped the buttons off his suit and scrawled baby fucker on his shirt.
Yeah.
That suit cost me $200, he whined. The shirt, $60. I don't have to put up with this kind of shit. I think I should have fair treatment from the press. I want to be segregated from other inmates. I have to sleep on the floor. I have to live like a dog. I've got no running water. I've got no light in my cell. I'm locked up 22 hours a day. I get one hour of exercise in the morning. Big fucking whoop.
Yeah. You just killed how many people? This guy, kids. He is like so narcissistic. It's insane.
Psychopath. Olson's whining generated front page news, but no one in the BC media reported the deal. The attorney general had personally wooed publishers and broadcaster executives not to reveal the pact. Even when questions about the payoff were raised in the House of Commons, they censored the information. What was front page news in Edmonton and BC was enigmatic brief. Did you even understand that sentence? Like, I sure as fuck didn't. What was front page news in Edmonton in BC was enigmatic brief. No one in BC wanted to be able to... I know what you're saying. Oh, this Lord. This is too advanced.
Okay.
No one in BC wanted to be blamed for violating the serial killer's right to be presumed innocent before the verdict was pronounced. In the end, the trial was aborted by Olson's guilty pleas. He dabbed away tears as he confessed publicly for the first time. After the court clerk read each charge of first-degree murder, Olson replied hoarsely, "Guilty." Tears streamed down his cheeks after the 11th and final first-degree murder charge was read. Justice Harry McKay said no punishment a civilized country could impose was adequate. "You should never be granted parole for the remainder of your days. It would be foolhardy to let you at large." Indeed, as he was driven away to serve his sentence, Olson confided to the accompanying officer that if he ever regained his freedom, he'd take up where he left off.
Yeah, obviously.
Even Olson's lawyer, Shantz, denounced the unprecedented agreement as improper. "I think it was politically insane, and I do not approve of it. We all know police pay informants, but I don't think they should have paid the culprit." Mm-mm. His lawyer said that.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
Columnists and talk show hosts condemned the police and vilified the attorney general. "I consider this case unique," Williams offered by way of explanation. "I do not expect it to occur again." He could not backpedal fast enough. "The decision was not an easy one for me, the RCMP, to make. It is a practice for monies to be extended in a variety of ways to obtain information, to protect witnesses, and sometimes protect others who may be associated with the crimes. This matter is an extension of that principle, one that I don't expect to see repeated. Pardon me. The crimes were so horrible, they should not be revealed. It adds nothing to dwell on details of that kind." Most never got over the shock that such an unseemly bargain had struck on their behalf. "There shouldn't be money paid to that creep," fumed Sigmund Wolfsteiner. "The guy who killed my daughter takes $100,000 from the government. You call that justice?" "That's salt in our wounds for us," said Raymond King, who lost his son. Montreal criminal lawyer Frank Schuffy summed up the reaction of many in the legal community: "The biggest judicial scandal in years." NDP MP Svend Robinson called for a public inquiry. Williams' career was finished. Police tried to unsuccessfully to recover the money, but they couldn't. The families pleaded for redress in the courts, but were rebuffed. "It floors me that anyone would think that I had anything to do with it," Joan Hale, Olson's wife, empathetically testified when the families attempted to legally compel her to return the money.
Yeah, give the fucking money back. What are you doing?
I cried a lot at first. I don't know how to explain it. I really don't think too much about them now. I'm glad the children are buried. Oh, I hate him. I hated him for the night he held a knife to my throat. He terrorized me, scared me, beat me. There was no one I could turn to. So the court let her keep her money.
She should have gave the money, like, to the victims' families. Like, what are you doing?
Mm-hmm. Oh, this is that lady. "I think that money was given to me in good faith," Hale said afterward.
Oh, yeah? Because your husband, like, threatened people?
"I don't have a guilty conscience. I can look myself in the mirror and say, you're a good person. Don't be ashamed." Oh. When she looked back on why she got involved with Olson, which I found this really intriguing, she said, "He's a real charmer. He has a way with words, and I've yet to see a woman that hasn't been attracted to him. I don't know what it is. I like to say it was his brown eyes, but it couldn't have been that." I can totally relate to that.
It's
height. You never date short men. It's just like a rule of thumb. You just don't do it. And it turns out
it's his height.
It's psychopaths. It's so fucking true. "It was something I thought I needed. I needed that companionship. I thought I needed someone to protect me from my husband because he was coming around and bothering me, and Clifford seemed like the perfect solution." Which we know, psychopaths are charmers. Ted Bundy. Mm-hmm. Also explains why he was able to lure children into his vehicle all the time. Like, and not just 8 or 9 year olds. Like, we're talking between 8 to 17.
Yeah.
Of her then 3-year-old son, named after his father, she said, "It's really strange. He knows who his father is. He picked it on from the TV. I just can't believe it. I just explained it to him that his dad was a bad person. He has to spend the rest of his life in jail and that we're never going to see him. And he accepted that. Whether he will later on, I don't know." 5.5 years after Olson picked up Christine Weller and drove her to a dump by the Fraser River in Richmond, the Supreme Court of Canada refused an appeal from the parents to examine the deal. Even after he was locked away for the rest of his days, Olson continued to plague police, his victims' families, and the public. He claimed to have murdered as many as 30 others, but was never able to prove what he was boasting. Despite leading investigators on an embarrassingly wild goose chase. Olson sent venomous, vulgar greeting cards to parents crowing about his brutality to their children. He sent pornographic letters to members of parliament. Where did he get these? No one has managed to explain why Olson was the way he was, and no matter how ill he might have been, he never turned himself in. The man with the best insight was probably Stanley Soramru, a top forensic psychiatrist who interviewed Olson at length in prison. He can kill, not out of anger or bitterness, but in a lighthearted way as a sport. He doesn't even grasp the enormity of or horror of what he has done. His is a personality which is devoted to exploiting and harming other people in his own interests. Seeing the death process was something he took substantial pleasure in. His claims of remorse are completely hollow. In fact, he says he deserves substantial credit from the families because of the fact he so generously helped to locate bodies. He used World War II as an analogy. He said, "We're friendly with the Germans and the Japanese now. Let's get over this too. Let's not make such a big deal out of this."
I hate this person.
Olson scored a 38 out of 40 on the Hare checklist, a clinical scale that rates psychopaths. It was the highest score Soramru had ever given any of the hundreds of murderers, psychopaths, and sexual offenders that he had studied. I found his descriptions to be quite nauseating compared to the other cases I've been involved in. His parents became inured to the regular visits from the police, the shame of the newspaper reports, and the continued disruptions their son's behavior caused in their life. They tried to help where they could, but had long given up hope in rehabilitating him. They only aimed to limit the damage he had done in their lives. Olson very fully appreciated the nature and quality of what he was doing, said former lawyer Shantz. That probably was the engine that drove him in terms of doing these murders. He had been free exactly 1,501 days from the time he was 17. Educated people have pored over his letters, analyzed his utterances, and scrutinized his speech. Unlike other mental illnesses, his aberration does not manifest itself in his manipulation of language or information. His reasoning was impeccable. There were no clues to indicate madness, as people understand it, either in a legal or normal medical sense of the word. Olson could quote at length texts, engage in sophisticated verbal debates, and cite chapter and verse of the criminal code. But when you contemplate his actions instead of his rhetoric, when you review his deeds instead of his eloquence, he quite clearly appears mad. So he checks out on every single thing except for his actions. And I find that really interesting because he dropped out in grade 8. He doesn't have an education.
Yeah, he's just fucking smart.
He's just smart. No one can say what creates or motivates such people. He seemed to suffer from a condition akin to a moral scurvy. It's what he didn't have, a conscience, that caused his pathology as near as a specialist can tell. He may have even been born with a biological defect that left him unable to feel or appreciate what is truly important in life. He mimicked emotion as if he were a human chameleon. The root of the trouble wasn't hereditary, nor does it appear to be linked in an upbringing. It remains an enigma. I mean, he had siblings who grew up to be middle class great people. He was just a really random thing.
Yeah, he was just like born that way. He wasn't made.
Sharon Roosevelt, a prominent victims rights advocate in the years following the tragedy of losing her son Darian, laminated along with many of the other families that Canada had abandoned capital punishment and spared Olson execution. She had one wish: let me pull the switch.
Oh, that's so sad.
And that's the story of the Beast of BC.
Thanks, Murderheads, for listening to another one of Murder, She Tapes episodes. Like what you heard, we need followers to know we don't just do this for our own entertainment. Well, kind of. Toss us a follow at Murder, She Taped on Instagram and continue staying up to date with our MST podcast and the fuckery of Nikki and Tay.
Have a story request? A local hometown crime you want us to share? Send us an email at murdershetaped@gmail.com with details to the story for our review. And remember, stay antisocial, Murderheads.